discuss with you what I find fascinating here in a tshuva from Rav Weiss, Rav Asher Zelig Weiss. He entitles it Experimental Treatments for Coronavirus. And he addresses two different, let's call it subcategories, of experimental treatments. And the basic issue or question in both of them is, does the halacha permit a person to participate in some sort of medical test or procedure that is totally experimental and has not been proven under normal situations, conditions? There would be no governmental permission of any sort for things that haven't been proven, but given the urgency of a pandemic, the government will allow this. But the question is, what does the halacha have to say about it? And specifically, to address the question of those people who would be willing to participate in this experimental, in the use of these experimental drugs, or to participate in trials. The first issue, as I said, it divides up into two, is the use of experimental therapies that have not been proven and could have severe side effects. He has a list here of different side effects, and he establishes, in order to make the question meaningful, that we're talking about situations where the patient himself or herself would likely gain something. Again, assuming that the experiment is successful and the therapy works. And he says that although under normal situations the authorities would be very cautious, they would not authorize the use of these medications, and especially in the case of a patient who's likely to survive, but given the urgency during this pandemic, many experimental treatments, therapies are actually being used. And now the question is, number one, a question addressed to the physician, and the flip side, of course, to the patient. To what extent does the halacha condone, possibly obligate, or in the worst case scenario, prohibit prescribing drugs and therapies that have not been proven that might be harmful? Now, I emphasize from the get-go that Rabbi Weiss, in the question at least, does not tell us how high the risk is. Every therapy has some element of risk involved. When you buy a drug in the drugstore, if you read the fine print on the page they give you in five different languages, you'll always find out that there are side effects, or at least the possibility of side effects. That has to be taken into consideration. And at least in the question, I think maybe in the answer he touches on this, but I want to go through this with you. He doesn't mention whether the risk is high or low. So for example, and I've given this example, which I have gleaned from the writings of Rav Meir Simcha Mitvinsk, certainly a woman is allowed to get pregnant, and pregnancy involves some element of risk. A A woman is not obligated, according to the Torah law, to become pregnant and have children. That's an obligation that's incumbent upon the men and not the women, but nevertheless she's certainly permitted to do so. Otherwise we'd have nothing left on the face of the earth, at least as far as Jews are concerned. Now, what exactly is the risk factor in the case of pregnancy? Do we want to say that maybe it's 1 in 1,000, and that's not a risk factor? But what happens when you get into more serious risks? So I have a friend who's written extensively on this topic, and his name is Dr. Howie Apfel. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was one of the pioneers, actually, because his field is surgeries for infants, but he went even further than that, and he does surgery in vitro, in other words, on the embryo itself, and he's had quite a bit of success. And he speaks about the risk factor. A lot of his writings revolve around whether halakhically the embryo has the status of a yalud, meaning of a chai, of a person who's alive. A lot of what he writes about is about the mother who's carrying the baby, because there is a risk factor in this invasive surgery as far as the woman is concerned. But one thing that I found extremely exciting and fascinating, when he talks about risk factors, he quotes a Gemara in Masechta Bava Metzia. I love it when the poskim quotes something that offhand has, you know, we call it in America from right field or left field, you know, somewhere from nowhere. And the Gemara talks about the issue of what's called onas dvarim, which could mean one of two things: either you overcharge or you undercharge, or underpay, I should say. So I'm selling you an object, it has a market value, we'll call it 100. And at what point does the discrepancy between the market value and what I demand that you pay me become significant enough such that it comes under the violation of a lav d'oraisa, an iser of onah? Well, if I charge you 102 for something that's worth 100 on the market, that's at least, again, I'm not talking about the Isra Onah, but at least that's not Onah in the sense of Bitul Mekach, that gives the buyer the right to back out of the deal. And there's something called Shtus, which means 1/6. It's Machlokas thing about how you calculate the 1/6. But in percentage points, it's approximately, again, I'm just rounding it off, about 16%. And that's considered a significant enough statistical probability or ratio such that you've overcharged him, and the seller and the buyer in this case can back out of the deal. And with a long discussion, and I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg, is he tries to make an analogy between the two, and at what point does halacha see a percentage as being significant. So that's the risk factor that has to be considered here. Then he comes with a second question. Now, we're not talking about administering therapies, which haven't been proven, but participating in experiments. And he says that he realizes that there are tremendous repercussions to this question in many different directions. He writes that he's afraid of the consequence of erring in matters of life and death, but he feels that the questions have been posed and they have to be addressed. Now, there are two ways of administering these experimental trials. The classic way of doing it is that we take a vaccine, we want to test it out, and we give it to two groups of people. One gets the vaccine, the other gets a placebo. And in this case, we're going to wait And we'll see in a minute how long we have to wait to get the results. And we can compare these two groups. And if we see that in one case, the group is healthy, and we can attribute that to the vaccine, and we can compare it to the placebo trial group, and we can determine whether the vaccine is effective. In that case, then once again, you have a group that might benefit from this trial, this vaccine, and the other group is getting a placebo in any event, so there's no element of danger or risk. But he has another type of trial or experiment, which he calls the human challenge vaccine trial. And in this case, which is much more complicated halakhically, two groups, both of which will be given some sort of a serious participation in the trial. And there's going to be an element of risk even for the group that is not suffering from the disease at all. And the reason for this kind of human challenge trial, which we'll try to fine-tune exactly what it is as we go along, is because it's only if you deliberately expose someone to a disease that you can test the results of the vaccine. So we're going to take people who are not suffering from this disease, and if they volunteer to do so, they'll participate, and they will actually be infected by the disease deliberately in order to test this vaccine. Now, the reason why we would want to do a human challenge trial as opposed to the classic trial is because we can get the results a lot quicker. When you're talking about waiting for the results of the vaccine long term, that could take months and months. That's not going to help us get out of this mess. So therefore, he writes that some groups propose a human challenge study in which two groups voluntarily and deliberately expose themselves to the virus, intending to be infected. And that will accelerate the findings of the study. And we're in a situation of urgency. All of those who participate in this human challenge trial are exposing themselves to danger. Some perhaps might even be risking death. May one voluntarily endanger themselves, join such a study for the greater good. So whereas in the first classical model of a trial, those who have already been infected by coronavirus will be given the vaccine. The other group is getting a placebo. No one is being exposed to an infectious disease who has not been exposed. In the second case, the human challenge, that's even more complicated, because now you're talking about voluntarily, deliberately exposing themselves to a virus for the purpose of becoming infected. They are not infected, they participate in this group, and for various reasons, this is going to overcome the slow rate of return, so to speak, of trying the trial and getting to the bottom line, because with the classic approach, there's social distancing, and it's very difficult to know what the rate of infection would be. It's very slow. The process would take a long time till they accumulate the proper results. And he goes ahead and analyzes this human challenge trial. Now, what I'd like to do with you, with your permission, is really study his tshuva. Till now, he's just been presenting the question and expressing his fear of chas v'shalom making a mistake in matters of life and death. Let me read to you the language of his tshuva as it's been translated by Dr. Yonah Rubin from the Hebrew. He writes that, can we allow a person, for the sake of saving someone else's life, or can we obligate a person for the sake of saving another person's life, to expose themselves to danger? Classic issue in halachic biomedical ethics. And he quotes three tshuvas. The first is the Tshuvas Radbaz, Rabbeinu David Ibn Zibri, lived about 5 centuries ago in Mitzrayim. And he says that it all depends upon the level of risk of the person who's exposing themselves to risk and the level of danger of the person that he's trying to save. And he comes to the conclusion that if the risk is small but real, the danger facing the other person is significant. And then he has the word here, common. I don't know what that word means. Then he says, although there's no obligation to expose yourself to risk, even for the sake of someone whose life is in danger, but nevertheless it's a midat chasidut to do so. Now, the Radbaz, to the best of my knowledge, is basing himself on the famous principle of Rabbi Akiva, Chayecha Kodmin L'Chayecha Vercha. But keep in mind that Rabbi Akiva was addressing the case where if you save someone else's life, you will perish. And Chayecha Kodmin, you don't give up your life to save someone else. And many poskim say you're not even allowed to do so. The Radbaz is talking about a different scenario. He's saying, look, I can't obligate you to put yourself into danger, but given the fact that your situation is unlikely, he calls it, it's notel esafek, whereas the other fellow's situation is notel evadai, his unfortunate situation is such that he will likely die if you don't intervene and save him. We have a principle, says Radbaz, called Ein Sofek Motzi Midei Vadai. However, even though Vadai is greater than his Vadai is greater than your Sofek, nevertheless, Radbaz says we still have to assume in a case of Sofek that you're risking your life, Chayecha Kodmin. So he takes Rabbi Akiva's principle one step further. Rabbi Akiva was talking about a case where you will perish in your endeavor, in your enterprise to save someone's life. The Radbaz is saying that the same principle of Chayecha Kodmin applies even if you won't perish, but you will put your life in peril. But he says, if that risk is a low risk, that's why I said at the outset that we have to define what's called high risk, what's called low risk, maybe convert it into, as I said before, percentage points and statistics, then for the sake of his almost definite loss, what? Not that you have to put your life into danger. Not that you have to expose yourself to some real danger. But you're allowed to do so. And that means midat chasidut. So if you would ask the rabbi, what should I do? The rabbi would say, go ahead and do it. So for example, to donate lama zog and a kidney for someone, now Baruch Hashem, the risk is very low these days, from what I understand. But even back in the day when the risk was a little bit more, you know, serious, to save someone else, the Radbaz would give it a brownie points, as we say, midat chasidut. Can't obligate you to do so. No one can tell you give up your kidney and live on one kidney for the sake of someone else, but you're permitted to do so because you're low risk and he's high risk, and we have a principle, ain't sofik motzim midei vada. Now here the Radbaz, argues against the Kesef Mishnah. They were contemporaries. Rav Yosef Cairo went through Mitzrayim and then he came to Tzfat. The Radbaz remained in Cairo in Egypt. He became the final posek there, wrote thousands and thousands of tshuvas. And the Kesef Mishnah of Yosef Cairo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, he went one step further. He said that ain't sofik motzi midei vadai, and therefore you're obligated to put your life into danger. However, the Kesef Mishnah bases himself on a Yerushalmi, and we don't know where this Yerushalmi is. No one is able to find the Yerushalmi. And therefore, if I could talk about that word, which I don't like so much, but normative halacha, in other words, the way the halacha evolves and it's mekubal in the poskim on these issues, we accept the Radbaz, and we're talking about a midat chasidut. Number two, and that's a tshuva from the Shvus Yaakov. I think his name was Reisher, if I'm not mistaken, about 200 years ago, 250 years ago. An Ashkenazic posek in this case. And he says the following. And we'll see if it's relevant to our discussion. A dying patient, the doctors give him 3 days to live. That's called Chai Shah. There's an experimental drug that one of two things is going to happen. Either he's going to die immediately, or he might live Chaye Olam for the rest of his life. He says the following, a dying patient who has only days to live, chaisha, the only way to possibly save him is by administering a medical procedure that might kill him immediately, or it might cure him fully, that's called chai olam. Says the Shvus Yaakov, he's allowed to take the medicine. Because although the Torah considers chaisha as life, but nevertheless, relative to chai olam, it doesn't rate. So for the sake of Chai Olam, even as a possibility, we can give up Chai Shah, which again means two things. Number one, that the doctor is allowed to administer that procedure. Number two, that the patient is allowed to expose himself. A third tshuva, which is even more recent, is called the Binyan Tzion, otherwise known as the Aruch Laner. He was the Rebbe, by the way, of Rav Shimshon von Hirsch. A lot of people don't know that. In Germany. We're talking about the mid-1800s. And without apparently being aware of the Shvus Yaakov and not quoting him, he has a proof from a Gemara in Avodah Zarah that if there's a chance of complete cure for someone who has fleeting minutes to live or hours or days, if there's such a chance, then the dying patient may take a treatment that might bring about his immediate demise. For a chance, then instead they may cure him, or this treatment may cure him completely. Now what's fascinating about the Binyan Tzion is that he quotes a Ramban. And I'd like to study this Ramban with you and see if it's really relevant to our discussion, because I have my doubts. The Ramban says, we have a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, V'rapo yirape, and he shall surely heal, addressing the physician. And Chazal tell us, Mikan shenitna rishus l'rofe l'rapos. Says Ramban, an amazing chiddush, a new pshat in this sugya. A physician will say, why do I need this responsibility? What if I make an error and I accidentally kill the patient? So the Torah says, V'rapo yirape. You have permission, and then we'll see about those poskim who say an obligation, to take this risk, to heal the patient, do the best job that you possibly can with the tools you have, even though you might kill the patient. And the Binyan Tzion sees in this Ramban that possibility of perhaps using a treatment that might kill the patient, but nevertheless it might save him. And it's mutter. I'm not sure that I understand the binyan tzia, what we call in Yiddish a tzushtel, his analogy. The Ramban is discussing a whole nother issue. The Ramban is not talking about some sort of atypical therapy or procedure that has not been proven. The Ramban, in a classic case that I would give you, is addressing a surgeon. Now, some people rate the surgeon by how many patients he lost over the course of time. You follow what I mean? You know, he's been doing heart surgery for 50 years and he lost 2 patients over 50 years. So he's a great surgeon. Other surgeons, unfortunately, have lost more patients. My father actually died during surgery, so heart surgery, so I'm a little familiar with the business. It's complicated. Of course, Dr. Isom from the center in Manhattan had a very good record. He very rarely lost a patient, but this is a standard procedure. All this, by the way, is relevant to Nezikin. If, let's say, someone was injured during surgery, does he have legal rights or recourse to sue the surgeon? And the answer always comes down to the same answer in all the poskim. Did the physician follow what we would call standard procedure? That's what you have medical books for, to tell you, and medical experts, they'll tell you what is the standard procedure given the facts. If the physician failed to check, you know, all the vital, numbers and so forth and so on, and he did something wild, then he's responsible. Let him go to the Ir Miklat. I don't know. But if he followed the standard procedure, it could be that his hand was not steady and he cut a little bit too much. I mean, again, I'm not going to give him shishi for that, but certainly he was following standard procedure. So the Ramban wants to know, well, what do I need? The physician's going to say, I don't want to get involved in that possibility. I know that during the course of X number of years, I'm going to lose Y number of patients. My son is in emergency medicine. You know, he's a young man, but he lost the patient. But you followed classic standard procedure. These are true and tried medical treatments, medications. That's the Ramban. The Binyan Tzion is talking about something else. Binyan Tzion is talking about introducing some element of a refuah which is not tried and true, and it's very dangerous. Do you have a right to sacrifice your life, or possibly do so, even if it means that your life is going to be cut down, immediate death, for the sake of a possibility and hopefully a probability that you'll survive? So again, Lamaisa, after all is said and done, the Binyan Tzion comes to the same conclusion as the Shavus Yaakov. I'm just not sure that I understand the proof and the analogy that the Binyan Tzion derived from the Ramban. So in the case of a physician providing unproven coronavirus treatments, where the physician realizes that there's a certain percentage of patients that will be harmed and maybe even die as a result of the treatment, and he's asking whether they could pre-prescribe, so the Binyan Tzion's answer to this question, if he were alive today, would be that the patient can take a very harmful chance over here because what he has now is just chayisha. Now, Rav Weiss goes ahead and he says he doubts whether or not the Shavus Yaakov and the Binyan Tzion would be really relevant to our issue. Why? He says, in most cases, the patients that we're dealing with may recover and never actually become critically ill. So that these tshuvas that we mentioned could be relevant, but only in a very circumscribed and specific limited number of cases. So for example, here in Israel, you know, we've lost over 300 people, Nebuch, and there's still a bunch of people who are in danger. And you can start making calculations and statistical probabilities. Again, there are a lot of factors that play a role over here, and decide in any particular case of a patient whether you're dealing with Chayisha. If you are dealing with Chayisha, and you're talking about a patient that doesn't seem to have much of a chance of survival, which doesn't mean, by the way, as I was told by one physician in New York City, that he's on a ventilator. Being on a ventilator does not necessarily mean that you're going to die. Again, I'm quoting you a doctor, I'm not going to mention his name, in Cornell Medical Center. And I'm sorry, in NYU Medical Center, Cornell's where my father passed away, but in NYU, who told us that if we have to put her on a ventilator, I have not seen anyone survive a ventilator. That was his lush. And Baruch Hashem, I could show you, this is my list of tefillin that I, you know, and tefillos that I say. It's a pretty long list, but I can tell you, I didn't cross them off the list, even though Baruch Hashem, they're out of the hospital, because they still need a long way to recovery. But many of these people were on ventilators. So we're not giving up on anyone who's on a ventilator, but let's say we come to the conclusion that Ploni Almoni is not going to survive. It's just not happening. His functions are... Then for sure we could apply the tshuvas that we mentioned, and we could be, you know, out of desperation, use any kind of treatment that you possibly can that might help him. But when we talk about either of our two questions, you know, you're talking about someone who is ill with corona, and you want to give them an experimental therapy, or someone who's not even ill and he wants to participate and volunteer for some sort of experimental trial. I mean, the tshuvas that we mentioned before are not really relevant. Therefore, Rav Weiss comes to the following conclusion in the first question, then we'll get to the second question. He says that every day, forgetting about corona, people undergo surgeries and treatments, and there are risks. No one pays any attention. No one blinks about it. And he says the following, that if we can define the risk and we can conclude that it's a relatively small risk, again we get back to the statistical question, then if this procedure could improve his quality of life, not necessarily for life and death purposes, then it's mutter, it's allowed. You know, very often when I read this, or this kind of writing, I automatically think of cosmetic surgery for a young woman, let's say. You know, we're not talking about life and death here, but... And there are other sorts of voluntary surgeries and so forth and so on. And there's always an element of risk. He says, therefore, it seems to me that one may try an experimental therapy to treat coronavirus, even though there's a possibility that the treatment may actually cause harm. And he says the following, that if it's a young, healthy person, at least until he was infected with coronavirus, he says it's unlikely that he'll become dangerously ill. But he says that if you want to use these kind of experimental therapies, he says it's more appropriate for someone whose life is in more of a potential danger, namely an older person. In other words, in the case of a young person, his risk from coronavirus is a low risk. Let's assume. Now, even if the experimental therapy is also a low risk, it doesn't seem likely that we should switch one low risk for another low risk and use a therapy that's unproven. But in the case of an older person, he says it seems appropriate that we use these unproven therapeutic methods. And why? Because there's more of a chance that this coronavirus patient might, chas v'sholem, give in to the disease. And he thinks that as long as the risk factor in this therapy is relatively low, you've got a situation where perhaps we have the Radbaz's logic that there's a greater percentage that of risk if we don't do anything, if we don't intervene. Again, we're not talking about chaisha. We're talking about, we have every right to assume that with time he may, pull through, especially in a young person, but even an older person. But nevertheless, there's still a risk factor in a more mature person. And if this therapy, which is unproven, could possibly give this patient a clean bill of health and restore his health, then he thinks that he stands more to gain than lose from this potentially harmful therapy. But he says, the second question, to get someone to volunteer and perhaps put his life into danger because he's going to be artificially infected when he's not infected. He says, number one, he doesn't get any direct benefit from it. It's not like the case of using a therapy that's experimental for a coronavirus patient. This fellow is voluntarily exposing himself and endangering himself to disease. He doesn't have any direct benefit. He's just there to determine the efficacy of the vaccine. And here he says it's less clear that there's halachic room to be lenient. And to be honest with you, I was in shock because usually when I read a posek, I don't know if you feel the same thing. It's like reading a novel, You can almost intuit, where we're going with this. You can almost guess the answer even without reading the tshuva. And I thought for sure, in this tshuva, there's no way that Rav Weiss is going to allow someone who's outside the safek to jump into the safek and volunteer to expose himself to danger. So I was quite shocked to find that I was wrong. And he writes the following. There's something called a vital communal need. And he gives examples. A policeman, a fireman. He doesn't mention a lifesaver, a swimmer. He calls them rescue workers, Hatzolah people. He says these jobs require individuals to accept more risk than ordinarily a person would take upon themselves. How does the halacha view this kind of thing? I mean, in my mind, firefighters or swimmers, I mean, the classic examples. You and I have heard of so many cases. I remember when I was a youth, there was a supermarket chain called Wallbounce. I don't know if anyone here is old enough to remember Wallbounce. So there's a Wallbounce on Ocean Avenue and Avenue V. And a fire broke out. 11 firemen, if I remember correctly, I was a young fellow then, perished in that fire. 11 firemen in one fire. and the whole place went up in smoke. Or the famous case, and there have been many off the coast of Florida, when she was drowning, he went in to save her, he drowned, another person went in to save him, and he drowned. I mean, unfortunately, Hayu Dvar Me'olam. But nevertheless, we're not going to say, well, you know, despite these communal needs that are vital, that we're not going to have policemen or firemen. So the halacha takes into consideration that if something becomes a vital communal need, then for those who can address that need in a life-saving situation, a capacity in which they will have to expose themselves to a higher percentage of danger, then it's mutter. And I was wondering, what is the halachic basis for this? He quotes a Bach, very interesting. The case is a judge, and the judge realizes that if he gets involved in handing down a verdict, and we could use the word mafiosos here, they might threaten to kill him or one of the members of his family. And yet the Torah says, Lo sagur bnei ish. And the Ramban, based on the Sifri, the Rambam as well, in Hilchas Sanhedrin, has a long discussion about this, how the Torah says you have to get involved in judgment, and that is your responsibility. And based on the Rambam, Rav Weiss wants to say that there's this concept of a communal Hatzalah person that, like the judge, has to Lo sagur mipnei sakana, has to jump into the sakon. Again, if you'd ask me personally, I would say that's midat chasidut. I would again invoke the Radbaz. I don't think the halacha would obligate anyone, even Mark Spitz, you know, to become a lifesaver. I don't think so, because there is an element of risk, and chayecha kodmet, the way the Radbaz applies it. But Rav Weiss is talking about a person who wants to volunteer for such an experiment and deliberately expose himself to coronavirus. His situation, according to Rav Weiss, is comparable to that of a policeman or fireman, a Hatzalah person. Why? Because he's doing it for the sake of a vital communal need. He says the following: while I admit that these situations are not exactly compatible, but seemingly our situation is one with a great societal communal need, and therefore a person can voluntarily expose himself to coronavirus in a controlled environment, since the danger to such a person is low. Oh, so keep in mind, he is limiting this. You know, b'medvar amurim. This is what we call in modern Hebrew histaygut, if you're familiar with that word. He is considering that the danger is low. Again, when a person jumps in to save a drowning person, I don't know what the percentages are. And Hashem will be meichel me, but who can tell me whether there's an undercurrent or not? You've got to respond within seconds, otherwise you lose your victim. Here he says it's a controlled experiment, and he claims that the morbidity rate from coronavirus, those who died, nearly all of them have been elderly. Okay, we unfortunately here in Israel we've had some exceptions to that rule. And there's a young woman now who's fighting for her life. He says, very few young people who are otherwise healthy have died of this disease. Therefore, if there's a low risk element by exposing oneself in that category of people to coronavirus, and there's a great communal need, which means that the results of this experiment may bring relief and health to untold numbers of people, then he says one can save tens of thousands of lives, and therefore it's permissible to participate in such a study. So again, he has his conditions. I'm not going to tell you carte blanche, you know, anyone could just volunteer for this. But given all these factors, he actually condones such a possibility. And he ends up by saying there's much to debate here. You know, he adds that proviso, you know, that but he says this approach seems to make the most sense. Now, at this point, he quotes the tshuva of the Noda B'Yudah. We've mentioned this many times in the past about autopsies. And the Noda B'Yudah says that for the sake of furthering medical research, that's not considered pikuach nefesh. And therefore, the autopsy cannot be permitted. And the same, says Nodudu, again, autopsy is a Torah prohibition, but he says even if it would be a rabbinic prohibition, then Nodudu writes that we cannot override even a rabbinic prohibition for the sake of furthering medical research, because that's not called pikuach nefesh. And therefore, the Nodudu prohibits autopsies for the sake of advancing medical knowledge. Would you apply the same logic here in our case, he analyzes, that here again, by participating in this experiment for the sake of advancing medical research, this should be absolutely prohibited by Halacha based on the tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda? What gives you the right to endanger your life, which is a violation of the Torah law, in order to participate with this experiment for the purpose of furthering medical research? And here's where Rav Weiss goes on and presents his very famous thesis that he's been speaking about over the course of, it's probably close to a half a year, that this is called Chola B'Faneinu, that now, you know, we are living in an urgent situation. We're not talking about medical advancement. You know, this is not medical research. This is not, as the Noda B'Yudah says, maybe someone 100 years from now is going to contract the same rare disease. Oh, no. We're talking about millions. Now, what's interesting to me, if I can make two comments, is comment number one is that in all of these cases, whether it's the Chola himself and an experimental medication or therapy, or it's a person who's not a chola and doesn't get any direct benefit who wants to volunteer, jump into the fray and be exposed to this virus, in all these cases, I'm quite sure that the halacha would absolutely require that the person, the patient or the volunteer for the experiment, would have to be appraised in very clear terms exactly what the risk factor is, what might happen. Now this takes us into a whole nother sugya. Let's say the chola himself is not capable of making that decision. Can others make the decision for them? Can the bezdin, can the rabbonim make that decision? This is an issue. But what's more important to me is my second comment. You may recall from last week that Rav Weiss addressed the question of a physician, Shomer Mitzvah, Shomer Torah physician, who's part of a very advanced group of scientists this physician who's asking the question, is claiming that we're part of a group that is very, very close to a major breakthrough in finding a vaccine for coronavirus. And the question is he allowed to travel on Shabbos and man the computer in this mad race 24/7 to try to find a vaccine? And in this case, you may recall, Rav Weiss prohibited it. And at one point in the tshuva, he mentions that writing on a computer might be doraisa. I'm not sure that that's the main point of the tshuva. I don't think he wants to battle that out with other poskim right now, who would probably take a much more liberal understanding of computer writing and probably reduce it down to a derabbanan. And in terms of getting to the hospital, we're talking about hiring a non-Jewish driver like we do here at Ezer Mitzion and so on and so on. And what surprises me is that when it comes to the experiment and volunteering to actually deliberately be exposed to the virus, which is even in a case of a low risk, is a pretty serious avera. It's not like the Torah said, you're a bialim, you're the balabas on your own life. That's not the permission the Torah gave you. A person who injures himself violates a lav d'oraisa, and suicide is basically ritzicha. I mean, you don't own your own body. That's the halach approach. Ushmatim yodas nafsh seichas. And now you can expose yourself for the greater good for society. And Rav Weiss is willing to allow that, because the greater good of society may have tens of thousands of lives on the line. It's chol b'fanenu. It's a pressing, urgent situation. I would have anticipated that Rav Weiss would likewise allow violating some derabbanans, or maybe even doraisas, for the sake of finding a vaccine. I'm not sure that Shabbos is less... Well, let me put it the other way around. I'm not sure that violating the Shabbos is more of a halachic concern in terms of chumras hadavar, the stringency of the matter, than it is to expose yourself to danger. So I'm not sure exactly, this whole concept of, exposing yourself for the benefit of society is a real issue. For example, we find that Esther Malka went into Achashverosh, and Kasher Avodati, she deliberately exposed herself to an intimate relationship. Until now, Achashverosh took the initiative, and she was Karka Olam, for those who know that Sugyan Sanhedrin. Then she was going to take the initiative and go in there and have an intimate relationship, Yael with Sisro, and things like that sort. And all of these are in order to save Klal Yisro from their greatest adversaries, their greatest enemies. And from that perspective, when we daven, V'chol Arisha, Keregio Vedu, I don't know about you, but I have in mind coronavirus. I mean, that to me is the greatest Russia alive today, And we ask Hashem to defeat that Russia. And I understand Rav Weiss and where he's coming from. The complicated issue is Yoav ben Tsruya, because the Rambam writes in Hilchos Rotzeach that a Rotzeach b'shogeg has to go to the Eir Miklot, and he's not allowed to leave the Eir Miklot, even for the sake of Hatzolas Klal Yisrael. The Torah says, Shom Yeshev, till the Kohen Gadol dies. And he gives the example of Yoav ben Tsruya, but you could be the greatest military commander, and Klal Yisrael desperately needs you to fight the battles against their adversaries, but nevertheless you don't leave the Eir Miklot. So what happened to the communal need over here? Some say it's Gzeiras HaKosuv. The Rambam derives it from a pasuk. But the pasuk might be teaching me that you're not obligated or even permitted, again leaving the Radbaz on the side, to expose yourself to danger even for the sake of saving Klal Yisrael. Because the moment you step one inch out of the Eir Miklot, the Gol Adam has the right to knock your block off and ain lo damin. But leaving aside the Rambam in Hilchos Rotzeach, we do find precedents in the halacha that there's a concept called Hatzolas Klal Yisrael. The one who writes extensively about this topic is Rav Kook. I'm talking about the original chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Ram Yitzchak, in his Mishpat Kohen. He writes extensively about this possibility of Hatzolas Klal Yisrael. The only answer I can give you is that although a person does not own his own body, and certainly not his own nefesh, and the halacha is very severe, very strict about someone who exposes himself to danger, and the only exceptions to that rule are possibly shluchei mitzvahinim nizokim. But even that case of shluchei mitzvahinim nizokim is only when lo shchiach hazeka. And the other exception is the Tshuvas HaRadbaz that we started with, that you can expose yourself in danger for the sake of someone who's in a vadai danger. I don't know if Rav Weiss is not really making the following calculation. Again, I'm just putting together two of his Tshuvas and trying to reconcile them. Then in the case of a vaccine, we can ask the question of immediacy. What's in front of you right now? In front of you now is the mitzvah of Shabbos. The vaccine, what should I say? It's a little bit like the Noda Biyuda. It's ein chol lefanecha. I mean, there are cholim lefanecha. No doubt Rav Weiss holds that. Millions of them. But as far as the vaccine is concerned, that's not considered chol v'fanecha. You want to be mechal Shabbos, let's use that term just in a general way. Who's going to allow you to be mechal Shabbos for the possibility that, oh, you're a big shot, you're going to find the vaccine? And he even says to him, well, come in on Sunday and work overtime on Sunday and take Shabbos off. You know, every physician, every lab experimental, he has to take off one day of the week. He can't go 24/7 for 7 days a week. So take off on Shabbos. So that's his attitude with regard to discovering a vaccine. There are many scientists out there who are trying to discover a vaccine, and we wish Hatzlacha. We've heard all sorts of stories, but you know, you never know what to believe when it comes to coronavirus. Asha Enkin, in the case of volunteering for this experiment, since Rav Weiss has added those two caveats, you know, those two provisos, that number one, we're talking about young people who are not, haven't been proven to be in a very dangerous profile group, and number two, what's at stake is the possibility of discovering a therapy. You see, we're not looking for a vaccine now. We're not looking out there and trying to put together, you know, chemicals and so forth. We're actually testing something out. We have in front of us something that could be therapeutic. I'm not saying it's a vaccine, but it could be a very important piece of the therapy puzzle. And there are so many different drugs out there that might be therapeutic. And you've heard all sorts of rumors about different drugs and that were used for different diseases in the past, and could they be helpful? And some would say, well, it, you know, this could cure pneumonia, so it's probably helpful. But you know, coronavirus is a lot more involved than just pneumonia. I mean, pneumonia is bad enough, and lungs and so forth, but there are other problems. You know, blood clotting and who knows what else. So that Rav Weiss sees this experiment as something quite serious in terms of prescribing therapeutic drugs. We have a drug, we have reason to believe, Alpi science, that this drug could be a helpful element in therapy for coronavirus, and exposing yourself by putting yourself, again, you're not a firefighter, but you've decided to become a firefighter. So Rav Weiss is going to say, anyone who's a firefighter has decided voluntarily to be a firefighter, but once he does so, he comes into a new halachic category because of the danger of the community, and he's playing such a role. You've decided that you are the firefighter. You are the fighter against this disease. You're going to be the one who participates voluntarily in an experiment that's going to establish that this drug X that we're taking is a therapy in certain cases, etc., for corona. You've made that decision. You're a low risk factor. You've taken it upon yourself to be, as I said before, you know, the Hatzolah guy, and nobody forced you to do so. The Allah would say that's midat chasidut, but it's acceptable. It's no worse than the Radbaz. So just to summarize, we have two you know, two tshuvas to two questions are both interrelated. One is where the chola himself or herself is going to expose themselves to a therapy that's very iffy, but they have so much to gain, and if they don't approve of that therapy, they have a lot to lose. And then we get into the statistics. And then we have a broader issue, which is more related perhaps to the Radbaz and others, about exposing yourself to a risk when you're not part of the risk. You're outside the circle of the Suffolk in order to save. And here we have these two factors, that it's a low risk because you're a healthy person, and what's at stake here are the millions. But to violate the Shabbos for the possibility of discovering a vaccine when there are thousands of scientists all over the globe that are trying to do this at the same time, and you can't take off any day of the week other than, at all. You know, it's not even Shabbos. That Rav Weiss is not going to allow. Okay. This is where we'll stop, and as I always end, we should hear B'sorot Tovot, and hopefully these experiments will produce results sooner than later, and a vaccine we'll be able to thank Hashem for saving us from this terrible disease. Ken Yeratzon Amen.